Hello, and welcome to the Game Audio Hour, a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio. From creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences, to audio secrets, here is where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio. This is episode 236. I am mostly not jet-lagged, I think. I'm Vincent Diamante, and I'm finally back in the States after a nice long vacation over the new year. It was pretty good. I don't need to get into it unless you guys really want me to and we really need to pad the episode out. No, I think we got plenty of stuff to talk about besides Japan being cool. But I'm not here alone. Hey, Mike, how are you doing?
I am doing splendidly. I'm not brave enough to travel during the holiday season, so as a result, I'm fairly relaxed, and I think I'm not jet-lagged, although the episode is young, so we'll see what happens.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Wait a minute. Alex, you are, by definition, always jet-lagged because you're always half the globe away in terms of time zones. So how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Vince. Happy New Year. It's the story of my life, really, isn't it? I'm always like half a globe away from you guys. No matter, even before I knew you, I was half a globe away from you. So I guess, I'm getting used to it. But, this jet lag takes a few decades to get over, I guess.
That's okay.
Anyway, how are you, Vince? Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year. Things are great. I took... just to really quickly do this, unless we really want to get into it, but I took a very long vacation in Japan. I've never actually taken a really significantly long vacation like this. Usually it's a week or 2 weeks. This one was basically 3 weeks in Japan. I had never Wow. been away from the country that long, unless it was, say the Philippines, where I actually lived for a decent amount of my life. But 3 weeks, and it's actually kind of amazing having that much time to just really relax, really forget about things that were getting that were going on the other side of the pond. Before, if it was 1 week, 2 weeks, I would just be thinking about work. I'd be thinking, oh yeah, I eventually need to get back to this thing. But over there, I don't think this is unique to Japan. I think it really is a function of just finally spending that much time away from home. By that third week, I was really in proper relaxation mode. It was really fun.
That's great. Did you, were you looking forward to coming back and getting back into the saddle and back into work again? Because you know you've had a successful holiday if you... At the end of it, you think, I'm ready. I'm ready to go back.
Yeah, I think so. It was fun. There were definitely a couple of things that I was preparing for, but again, not in that dreading way that it would be in previous attempts at vacation. It's just, I had a couple of notes that I made for myself on my phone while I'm at the airport on the way home. And I thought, I'm looking forward to trying this out now. And I'm looking forward to following up on this correspondence from the end of last year and things like that. Nice. Yeah, I think I'm back in the saddle, even though I am very, very slightly jet lagged still.
Were there any components of your trip that were game audio related? Did your work life sneak into the vacation in any way?
Early on, I had a really interesting musical experience at this one hotel. So since this was kind of a vacation slash gift for my wife, I decided to splurge on a couple of nicer hotels. And one of these places early on in the trip was very nice, very posh, and it had music all over the place. But one of the things that really struck me, maybe it was because it was early on in the trip and my mind was still in game audio land to some degree, I kept on thinking about the incredible disjunct between all of these spaces and how effective and startling it was. And what I mean is that I would be in the lobby and it would be this sort of soothing ambient sort of wash. And then I would go into the elevator and then it would be, something, romantic, or late classical romantic music. And then I would step out of the elevator into the floor where our hotel room is. And then it would be this sort of lo-fi kind of trip-hop type of beat. And I was, wait a minute, what? Wow, there's like all these genres happening. And they would be shuffling all the time. I would go back down and I would get three more genres. It'd be like, oh, okay, here's some sort of, fusion-y Showa era pop. And then it would be sort of this acoustic version of like some 80s or 90s American rock standard. And then it would be, some sort of a cool jazz thing like Miles Davis after that. It was like, wow, there was this incredible shift between all these genres. And there was a part of me thinking, is this good? Is this right? Is this what is intended? And there was a part of me thinking, yes, this is good because I know exactly where I am, or at least I know when I've crossed the divide. And then there was another part thinking, for as much music as there is here in this hotel, in all these spaces, there definitely doesn't seem to be a singular musical identity here. So I was definitely thinking about that when it came to what should I be doing? What should I be doing when it comes to creating music for a virtual space? After a while, again, by the second, third week, I definitely wasn't thinking about that stuff and just sort of letting how musical Japan is just wash over me because it is a very musical world. But in the beginning, yeah, I was kind of thinking about it Busman's Holiday style.
Which makes me wonder a little bit about how we might think of hotels or real-world non-gaming spaces in dynamic audio terms. From your description, it sounded like that there were music triggers associated with each level, if you will, where, the elevator is a level and the lobby is a level and maybe the floor with the rooms is a level, but that there was not a lot of artistic coherence between the levels, and there was variety within the levels. So maybe there's a, I wonder what is making those decisions and what the granularity of the decisions are. Are there different spaces have different music radio stations plugged in? Is there a preset library and it cycles through, but it's isolated to a particular area? And can game audio technology be used either literally or as a kind of model for presenting music in these complex spaces?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder about that. With game audio, it's so centered on the individual player. And I kept on thinking about things in those terms. Like, can the hotel know about me? Like, should the hotel actually track me? And I certainly was thinking about that because there were other technologies that I was coming across in Japan that led me down that path. Things like when you walk through the entrance to the lobby of the hotel, there would be these cameras that would take pictures and video of you, and they would actually measure your skin temperature as you were walking past, one of the various COVID measures and actually ubiquitous throughout Japan. Every hotel, every nicer restaurant, they would have these things. A lot of cameras, a lot of technology in place. And I was thinking about that, like, oh, can this thing actually give me a personal experience? And thinking about things that way and is actually a better way to do it in the game world versus perhaps the more realistic thing where you have different sources of audio that are constantly playing. You have distinct 3D emitters that are constantly going to be on and pumping out audio. In a game space, you would not necessarily want to have that because you're wasting resources playing audio that's not actually going to be heard by anyone in this space unless someone is there, but you don't necessarily know that. These things are just dumb fire and forget stuff. So
well, I was thinking, so you point out a huge fundamental difference between a hotel and a game, and that is the lack of individuation in the audio experience, because you're all listening to shared speakers. There has to be some kind of consensus among the people in the hotel with respect to what kind of musical mood is appropriate, and then how that mood could be evoked through selection of a particular musical style. The age of a particular hotel guest could radically impact whether they find EDM relaxing or a newfangled noise, for example. But you also bring up a really, intentionally or otherwise, you bring up a really interesting point, and that is the idea of tracking individuals, which I suspect could be done trivially given the use of digital hotel room keys, right? Mm-hmm. And if there's any place that we expect to be on the cutting edge of technology in this, in all respects, it's Japan. So it's not unreasonable to assume that the hotel knows who you are and maybe even where you are to varying degrees. And perhaps if it knew that you were the only guest in a hallway, maybe it could drum up something specific. Or maybe it could kind of say, okay, the median age of all the guests in this area is 30. So we have a mood directive and we have a demographic analysis. Let's bring in the music that most makes sense. So there could be, and maybe if it's a big crowded space with guests from different ages, you can't narrow the music down by genre and you have to use broader strokes. Mm-hmm. But it seems like there's some fascinating opportunities here. And at least some of the problems are similar to what we face in game music and game audio.
Yeah. You mentioned hotel keys. I think that's definitely something that can be done. But also, I've been reading a lot of stuff about how Wi-Fi, as ubiquitous as it is, has been expanded and extended with more functionality by researchers figuring out how to read Wi-Fi signals and how they change as people actually move through them. So now things like figuring out how many people are in a space that have so many Wi-Fi routers. I don't just mean by how many Wi-Fi devices they have in their hands because everyone has a cell phone. No, they're just reading the fluctuations of Wi-Fi waves just traveling through the air as people are walking through it. And they figured out not just how many people are in there, but there's some new research that shows them figuring out, oh, these people are actually making these poses, and I could actually turn these into 3D meshes that can be used for other purposes. Let's actually track their body movements just using the existing Wi-Fi waves with very, very good fidelity, where you could see them opening a hand versus closing a fist. It's really quite crazy.
Wow.
That's both impressive and disquieting.
Alex, you've been at your new place of residence for a while, but before that, you were in Japan for a pretty long time. I'm sure you must have some thoughts about how Japanese spaces actually use music, right?
Yeah, it's really, really fascinating. You know, one of the things that you said just there that actually I've been just pondering more so than implications for game audio here, but it is sort of relevant to game audio in some sense. And that is when you said that this hotel lacked a sense of musical identity because, you know, wherever you were going, there seemed to be a different genre playing. That is really, really fascinating. And that's one of the things that was quite surprising and quite thought-provoking for me when I lived in Japan. I was there for 16 years. And one of the most fascinating things that I found was that genre and musical identity aren't necessarily connected in the same way that they are for people in, you know, Western European, American, Australian traditions of music. You know, we tend to associate, okay, for example, rock and roll music. That's in itself, that is, together with that, you have a history, you have, you know, fashion, you have it's kind of a cultural aspect that's tied in with rock and roll music in the same way that you have a cultural aspect that's tied in with, say, hip hop or techno or classical music or country and Western music or et cetera, et cetera. curiously, one thing that I found in Japan is that they seem to not identify that musical identity together with genre in the same way. So one of the things that may have been, you know, for them, the fact that you go into different areas of this hotel and there's music playing in every one of them, if we assume for a moment that this hotel didn't structure their musical programming just randomly and that there was some thought put into, you know, where and what would be playing, perhaps there's a thread that joins together all the different things that you are hearing, which is something other than genre. You know, it's curious. I've actually been doing a little bit of research on some classic Japanese arcade titles for a project that we're doing this year. And one of the interesting things that I noticed, especially around the mid-90s era of Japanese game music, is they are very unprecious when it comes to sort of genre cues. You know, mm-hmm. It's kind of like something for everybody. Oh, it's like some power chords from a rock guitar, and then there's a rap bit, and then there's like, you know, e-piano with some nice smooth strings behind it as well, and then there's a saxophone. All of a sudden, why not? Let's have a saxophone. You know, oh, and here comes the power metal guitar on top of the saxophone, together with the rap bit and the strings and the e-piano all together. There's something for everybody here. It's a mixed pot. You know, from the Western perspective, you would listen to that and you say, what even is this? Like, it's not rock. It's not, you know, smooth jazz. It's not hip hop. It's just like everything mashed together. And that very sort of unprecious approach to genre is something that I left Japan feeling that is quintessentially Japanese. They have a very different idea of genre and how it applies to the culture, the backdrop of culture behind different styles of music as we see them in the West. So potentially this hotel, potentially there was a lot of thought put into the fact that, you know, perhaps, for example, all the genres of music that you were hearing were, I don't know, particularly happy sounding. And it's that happiness, you know, it's that bright, energetic feeling is what they wanted to get across. And the fact that you were walking through, you know, like zones of smooth jazz and zones of, you know, Showa era pop music and zones of I don't know, classical or whatever, that didn't really present any kind of problem or sort of artistic lack of continuity to the hotel. Of course, this is all assuming that it was all intentional. It may not. It may have just been, let's just have some music because music is nice.
So yeah. There's more of a, what we would consider a variety show type tradition, is what you're saying, Alex, that the kind of eclectic sound is taken for granted, and instead that we would find continuity in how each style, the emotion that each style is trying to approximate by its own methods.
That's right, yeah. One thing is for absolutely sure, and I know that you both will agree with me, and actually most fans of any kind of Japanese pop culture listening to this will agree with me, but Japanese people and Japanese consumers have extremely sophisticated artistic sensibilities. And oftentimes, like, for example, when I'm working on stuff here and my wife comes in, my wife is Japanese, she often offers these really, really bizarre comments based on what I'm doing. Like, for example, she might come in, like, if I'm doing something really, really aggressive, you know, something very sort of tough and powerful and aggressive, she might come in and say, kawaii ne. And it's like, what? How is this kawaii? This is supposed to be like, you know, punchy and powerful and aggressive. And, you know, often the sort of the aesthetics of the sound are completely disconnected from the cultural baggage that we as Westerners tend to bring to all of these genres. So, yeah, I think you might be right there, Mike. It could be just the case that every genre, every one of those genres that you were hearing there, Vince, was attempting to create a similar emotion in its own way that is consistent with its language, you know, because every genre will have a language that it expresses itself in. But when you don't see it that way, when you only hear the genre and you only bring to mind the cultural associations with that. It all just feels like a big mishmash. However, yeah, potentially it could be sort of a consistent emotional objective behind all of them, even though they're represented in different ways. Very fascinating.
It was really fascinating. Eventually, it just became, wow, Japan's cool. I mean, you go on a vacation, you know, away from your hometown in order to experience some different stuff and just sort of luxuriate in those differences. And it was really nice to be able to do that. Those interesting approaches to music in various places. It wasn't just this hotel. It was other spaces. It was, you know, things like, oh, when I go into the department store or when I'm out in the street in the shopping arcade and these songs come up. And it was really great. It's, you know, I see people talk about how, you know, big cities everywhere are the same, right? You know, everything is the same these days in the 21st century. And if you're in a city of 10 million plus people, and to actually, Tokyo is much more than that. But you know, once you cross a certain threshold that, oh, big cities are all pretty much the same. It's all global culture anyway. Everyone's listening to the same top global hits. No, it really isn't the case in Tokyo. And then I went outside of Tokyo and it was even more different, which was great. Probably the highlight of my trip was just hanging out in a ryokan inn, a traditional ryokan inn that had a very nice onsen bath and just nice. Bathing in mineral hot spring water for as much as I can over the course of those 3 nights. So much bathing. God, I love onsen culture.
Nice. So speaking of Japan, to kick this year off actually in the green room prior to hitting the record button today, Mike said, not Happy New Year, but Happy New Gear, because I have a gear topic to discuss. Kicking off the first game audio hour of 2023 in typical gear-oriented style. So it is kind of a segue from Japan, because I'm going to get to a point here, but before I do, I want to ask you both, what is your go-to resource for sort of bread and butter sounds? Do you have, you know, one place that you always go to when you just, for example, you think okay, I need a string patch. All right, I'm just going to go to my insert answer here and pull out a string patch. Or I need a quick pad. Okay, just grab one from here. You know, for example, obviously you've got Native Instruments Complete, and you've got UVI has Falcon, like, which comes with a big library, and you've got like Omnisphere, and you've got the Roland Cloud, and you've got Halion, and various sort of, you know, big, I guess, rompler is the best term, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But what, starting with you, Mike, what is your sort of go-to resource for just bread and butter sounds like that?
Well, it sounds like you are speaking from the standpoint of kind of electronic contemporary music production, because my answer would differ depending on whether that's the palette we're talking about or we're thinking more of orchestral emulations. So running with that, I don't have a single source. I've in past episodes talked about how I've tried to build my own greatest hits abstract library and have searched through many organizational tools for trying to consolidate it all, the most current of which is Bear, the note-taking app. So I can tell you what my frequent flyer libraries tend to be, but I suspect that's not addressing whatever it is you're trying to segue into.
Okay, good answer. I'll accept that. Mm-hmm. Vince, how about you?
Yeah, you know, I've done a lot of stuff lately where it's just, oh, right, this is in sort of a modern orchestral idiom, right? And in that case, I'll just open up my template, which changes basically once a year. You know, I'll try to do a refresh to it, and so I go to that. But if it's something else, I do have hardware that I go to just because I like it. and I was able to make a template for it such that I can access all of it after turning on a power strip and then adding a adding these tracks in Reaper that correspond to my rack of a Roland Phantom XR and a Proteus 2000. So
nice.
It's really quite easy to access all that stuff. It's almost as easy as, well, it pretty much is as easy as clicking through a drop-down menu to go through banks or search for instruments by strings. It just doesn't look quite as fancy as a modern soft synth VST where you have a really nice graphical UI. This is kind of bare bones, but it's really quick for me to do that. So yeah, I can access my my rack gear pretty quickly these days.
That's cool. So a little towards the end of last year, I subscribed to Roland Cloud. And here is what I wanted to segue into. Since then, I've sort of had the opportunity to put Roland Cloud through its paces several times, and I'm sad to say I'm very conflicted about it. I really want to love it because I'm a bit of a shameless Roland fanboy. I just love Roland, and I've started to wonder whether I'm loving Roland more for its legacy than for what it's doing these days. Because, yeah, I don't know. I mean, so just for some context, I have a JV-1080 and I have a Roland D110, which I absolutely love. And I also have a Roland MKS-50. MKS-50 we'll leave out because mm-hmm. that's an analog synth. But the D110 is a pre General MIDI early rompler, and the JV-1080 is obviously Roland's flagship rompler that was around in the mid-90s, I believe. So one of the things that I love about the sounds that come out of the 1080 and the D110 is that they are so plain, they are so mediocre, mm-hmm. and so kind of boring that they are extremely easy to use in production. You know, they just talk about bread and butter. They just sit there perfectly. They don't take up too much space. They don't take up too much attention. They serve exactly what it is that you are wanting it there for. You know, as a good example, like I needed to create. So the soundtrack that I'm working on the moment for this new project, which I'll hopefully be able to talk about pretty soon, is very mid-90s game music inspired, which is the reason why I was listening to a lot of stuff from Japan from that era, and I needed a really sort of crappy General MIDI sounding string patch, right?
Crappy, okay.
Yes, crappy. So
was that the actual client specification for the sound?
That's right. Make it crappy, and I said, understood. I will deliver. And naturally, so since I'm subscribing to Roland Cloud, I thought, well, I'll just try Roland Cloud, and no, it's like. It has the same problem for me that Omnisphere has, is that everything has too much presence. It's like too thick and too big and too wide and just too everything. And it wasn't just today. It was also, you know, every other time that I've tried to use anything from Xenology, it just doesn't sit well. It's really hard to mix. It's just too big somehow. Meanwhile, of course, the Roland Cloud is not only about Xenology. You also have all of the ACB stuff, the sort of vintage emulations. They are absolutely incredible. They sound so good. They are definitely, you know, worth the price of admission, despite Xenology. But yeah, it was really disappointing that, like, every time I go to use Xenology, these patches are just, I don't know, they just are so hard to work with. They're just too big. And then, you know, just flick on the JV-1080, go straight to a string patch. It's perfect. It's kind of boring. It's flat. It's plain. But you know, vanilla ice cream. It's sort of flexible and it goes well with everything. And, you know, you can't go wrong with vanilla ice cream. Whereas the Roland Cloud stuff, I mean, it's just, yeah. So Have either of you had the similar experience with Roland Cloud, or Vince? Do you have the XV, and theoretically the Roland Cloud sounds, they have the XV sounds there as well.
Yeah.
But have you ever found this that it's hard to mix with?
I did, but I'm not sure if I would put too much credence on that, considering my last time really seriously trying to do Roland Cloud stuff was maybe 2 years ago. And I've kept up with it a bit, just sort of watching it in the news. But after I settled on my rack gear, which allows me to do specifically the things that I want to do with it, and I don't need to load up a synth. And at the time, the Roland software did have a bit of a reputation for not being the most ironclad, stable software out there. I decided not to really pursue Roland Cloud that much. It did kind of seem like there were some weird, different philosophies and sound with the various, with the various lines of synths that they made available. Because I had a lot of fun with the older stuff, the anthology stuff, the the SRX stuff, which are that's Roland from the 90s and what I was very familiar with and which I have a little bit of fondness developed for. And then there's the new stuff, the Xenology stuff, which is, oh hey, it's an advanced synth. You can do all sorts of stuff with it. Does it sound exactly like any particular hardware? Maybe it does, because I think everything these days, when it comes to Roland hardware, the advanced stuff is this FPGA Zencore stuff where the software is exactly what is going to be running on the hardware and whatnot. But it did strike me, even though I didn't go really deeply into all of it, that these were different. It almost felt like different companies with different sounds, the same way that Korg is a different sound from Roland, which is a different sound from Emu. So I kind of had that feeling about it as I was playing around with these different soft synths, ostensibly from the same space.
I kind of wonder if there's a kind of a loudness war going on between the synth manufacturers where, you know, if we just make it bigger and wider and fatter and more full frequency, then that's going to sound better to the consumers than if it's sort of more plain and more watered down and more simple and more narrow and basically easier to mix. Because, yeah, the same goes with Korg. I haven't tried any of Korg's modern day sort of Rompler style stuff. But the Korg M1 and WaveStation plugins that you can get with the Korg Legacy collection, they're also fantastic. You know, those sounds just work so perfectly everywhere. So I don't know, maybe when it comes to these sort of so-called bread and butter sounds, maybe we hit like the zenith point somewhere around 1998 or 99, and we've been going down since then. Well, what do you think, Mike? Because you had a JV-1080 as well previously, right?
Oh, I did, yeah. And the, what was the precursor? I had the 880 as well.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
I can't help but wonder if some of what you're describing, there's this showmanship in patches, because soft synth manufacturers know that the typical potential customer is comparing apples and oranges. And if they have a very hyped sound, as you say, very bright, very wide, maybe there's a lot of delay and reverb slathered on, and you just start playing with it, there's a gratification, right? A sonic gratification, so that there's this tendency to just slather on the hype. And I wonder if one possible solution could be the approach taken by East West in a non-synth context. If you look at their newest in-house sample player, which is Opus, it has each sound, or at least their orchestral library, but I think all of them have three modes, which are approximately mellow, normal, and hyped. And
oh, okay.
The details vary from instrument to instrument. I think this may just be their new orchestral refresh, but for the sake of description, if you go in the mellow mode, if you've got a string sound, it'll go consort, or maybe the reverb selection will change. And then the hype mode turns on all the close mics, so you get that really bright present sound, and the classic sound might be the default for what the sound sounded like under play. And I wonder if soft synth manufacturers could adjust something so you have like show-off mode, where there is all this brightness and color and gratifying sugar on the sound, and then maybe more sedate mix mode where that stuff is stripped away and the reverb is simpler, et cetera, et cetera. And it's perfectly okay to have the system default to show-off mode, you know, showmanship mode. But then just to have a button that will slide a number of knobs all at once to put it in a space where it'll behave better in a mix.
That's a really smart idea. I've actually seen that done on two soft synths. One is Yuhi Hive, and the other is the open source Surge synth, which if you weren't aware of, you should definitely go and check out because it's absolutely fantastic. Surge used to be a synth by, who was it by? It was by Sonic Charge, maybe? No, it wasn't Sonic Charge. But Surge for many, many years went unmaintained because the single one-person developer behind it was just too busy doing everything else. So at the end of all of it, he open-sourced it. And now Surge is, without a doubt, the most fully capable, fairly easy to use, well-designed, very attractive-looking open-source soft synth that there is. And both Hive and Surge have there's a toggle, like warm versus bright, and you can switch between in Hive you actually got, I think it's dirty, clean, and I can't remember the third one, and in Surge I think it is warm and bright. But it's actually exactly what you described, Mike. Like, the bright mode is like, wow, synthesizer,
right?
Fantastic. But if you actually want to use it in the context of a mix, yeah, unless it is, you know, the big powerful lead that you want everybody to listen to above everything else, switching it into mellow mode or warm mode makes it much easier to work with. It just sits much better. I'd certainly like to see something like that in Omnisphere, because Omnisphere is another example of the same problem that I'm finding with Roland Cloud, where a lot of Omnisphere patches are amazing. Like, they're just incredible. It's just like a whole song in one note. In one patch, you could just, there's your song, the center of every song.
Yeah.
However, if you're going to go to Omnisphere and just grab a string patch to throw into the background of your mix, or, you know, okay, I need an e-piano. Give me an e-piano right now. You know, Omnisphere is often, I've found anyway, maybe I'm just not looking, maybe I've selected the wrong tags when I'm looking through it. It's just sort of too much. It's just like too big, too fat. So for sure, Roland Cloud and Omnisphere could use such a feature that you described, like that, Mike, like a bread and butter mode.
You need a non-pejorative term so that it doesn't alienate prospective buyers. Just call it mix mode or blend mode.
Yeah.
Blend mode. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I'm looking through Hive again because, three synthesis engines: normal, dirty, and clean.
There you go. That's it.
And that's, I mean, that sounds great. I remember playing around with it, but I it's been honestly at least a year since I've loaded that up. So I've long since forgotten about that.
Yeah, all of this was very relevant to me because at the end of last year and the start of this year, I was suddenly dropped into Project Hell, where a project suddenly realized that they needed sound, and then I was brought in 3 days before the deadline to go and race through making music for them. I'm sure all of the game audio warriors out there are listening to this, nodding their heads, thinking, yep, know that one. Sound is really important. And then 3 days before the deadline, oh no, we forgot to put in the music, quick. Anyway, in those kinds of situations, it's quite good actually, because, you know, when you're working really fast like that and you just have no time to even stop and think about, oh, which tool shall I use? Yeah, the ones that are really the ones that are suited to your workflow tend to float to the top. And yeah, sadly, Roland Cloud, there were too many times when it's like, okay, quick, go. I need like a, you know, like a brass, a stupid synth brass sound. Pull up Roland Cloud, start clicking on the tags to find brass. The patch organization is very comprehensive, so that's great. Go through all of them. No. And in the end, I ended up actually using ChipSynth, the DX7 from Plogue.
Yeah.
And it just like, oh, perfect. Straight in there. Yep, that's it. That's what you want. Move on. So
Plogue stuff is so good.
I know. I've been using the last Black Friday, I bought the Plogue ChipSynth MD, which is the Mega Drive FM engine.
Mm-hmm, yeah. That's specific OPN. Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic because it's so gritty and dirty and kind of crusty. And when you, whatever you need to do with it, if you're putting sort of modern day, like for example, some of the pads, they have all this kind of aliasing and grit and dirt, and they sound horrible unless you've got, you know, some nice effects on them. But I matched it up together with Tai Chi, which is my new favorite reverb, and just sounds, all of that noise coming out of ChipSynth MD just translates into this beautiful wash when you put it through a big reverb. Just incredible.
You know, to tie this topic into some of the New Year's resolution topics, one resolution I've had for myself, which I may or may not have mentioned during our actual New Year's show, was to try to get more out of what I have rather than constantly get new gear. Fairly generic kind of audio tech resolution, but I'm doubling down on it this year. Mm-hmm. So I recently did a TV movie, and for me, it was a fairly synth-heavy project. This wouldn't be a synth-heavy project for you, Alex, because I didn't draw the waveforms on graph paper and then program my own algorithm to generate them. But for me, it used some kind of stock synth sounds. And what I tried to do was really plunge into my existing collection. Well, I should say my first impulse was like, go through every synth you own, go through every single patch, make a huge collection, be ready to have all of these at your disposal. And I thought, you know, like, it's not compatible with the reality of workflow under a deadline. So I tried to get better at twiddling with the parameters of a few synths just so I could take basic sounds and then change them into what I wanted. One of the more frequent flyers in this respect was BX Oberhausen, which Brainworks' attempt to do like an Oberheim style classic synth. Yeah. And I found that when I took the time to, in some case, disable the bright, shiny stuff, like what we were just talking about, but do some good old automation tweaking, I got some really great results. And I remember that, you know, there was a time when you'd have a synth box and that thing was responsible for your palette. So there is something to be said for getting good enough with one thing to draw from it a particular thing that you're hearing in your head rather than, and this is more of a confession on my side, not accusing either of you of doing this, but rather than cycling through endless presets, waiting for something to come and match what you have in mind.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, I absolutely agree. The past 2 or 3 years, actually, the one synth that I've been coming back to again and again, if I had to sort of name top three, number one would definitely be Yuhi Budzeel, which is their modular sort of an FM synth. It's based on what you can do FM, and that's its main selling point. But Budzeel is you drag cables around. It kind of looks like a virtual Eurorack kind of setup. But I know exactly what you mean because there's a real utilitarian usefulness to knowing exactly how to get the sound that you want from one particular instrument. You just go, okay, I know if I want that. Okay, bang, bang, bang. There, it's done. The one that I'd like to get to that point with. Ultimately is ChipSynth OPS7, the DX7 mm-hmm. from Plogue, because the DX7, firstly, that Plogue stuff just sounds incredible, as Vince said, but that the DX7 one just sounds really amazing. And you might think that, well, hey, I mean, the DX7 is a digital synth based on FM synthesis. Like, how, I mean, really, yeah. If you're running that on a computer, how good can that get, really? I mean, it's, you know, it's just digital technology and digital technology. I mean, big deal. No, there's something pretty amazing going on behind, under the hood of that one. But of course, yeah, being this based on the DX7 architecture, it's fairly hairy. It's quite a difficult one quite a difficult nut to crack. But yeah, that'd be. I'd like to get to that point of familiarity that you talk about, Mike, with that one for sure. But yeah, BX Oberhausen is really nice. The other one, if you are, this goes in contrary to what you were just saying about learning one synth instead of getting new gear, but GeForce's SEM, which is actually officially endorsed by Oberheim itself, is also really, really fantastic for that Oberheim sound. GeForce I recently got their Oddity 3, which is based on the ARP Odyssey, and that's also fantastic. GeForce is a company that I've known about but never really dived that deeply into, and much like Plogue, last year, in the second half of last year, I was just really enjoying everything from Plogue and also everything from GeForce. So, yeah. Sorry, Mike, I think I just derailed the entire message that you were delivering there about learning your tools instead of constantly getting new ones. But yes, anyway.
Yeah. Well, let's see. I've been trying to get back in the saddle when it comes to piano. Not playing piano for 3 weeks. Whew. Wow. It's been a while since I've actually touched any sort of keyboards. And then I finally came back from vacation a week ago. Like, oh, wow. I feel markedly weaker than I was before. You know, I was already losing some strength just playing synth key beds as opposed to real pianos for a long time. But even just over 3 weeks, I thought, yeah, this doesn't feel quite as strong as I'd like it to. I need to work on just basic strength training before I can get back into building virtuosity.
Prior to your holiday, like last year, did you have like a regular practice schedule that you would adhere to?
There were a couple of things that I entertained a bit. It's kind of one of those not enough hours in the day. So often I find that if I make time to practice my iwi, which is not really my primary instrument, but I use it all the time, then I find that I'm not having the time to practice piano and vice versa. So I try to get about, you know, 30 minutes to an hour of just, I'm going to practice. I'm going to do scales. I'm going to do arpeggios. I'm going to do basic practice and just get my fingers warmed up. And if I do that, then usually I'm at a point where, all right, now that I've done this, I got to work on stuff, which is very different from, okay, time to switch modes and practice my piano. So usually one or the other has to give. So it's a little bit tough. I'm still trying to work out the schedule, but I really want to see if I could get both done.
Cool. That was actually my New Year's resolution for this year, is to get better at the keyboard. So I should follow in your footsteps.
Well, we can keep on comparing notes as the year goes on. I really do want to keep on pushing on this and get better as a performing musician. So let's see. We've been going at it for a while. Maybe we should get into some conspicuous consumption, shall we? Alex.
Okay, let's do it.
Oh.
Let's start with Mike.
Okay.
I want to hear from Mike.
You make it sound like I have something really exciting.
It's plotted, Elden Ring. Elden Ring, right?
No. Oh, but yes, but no, that's not what I'm going to mention. Let's see. I've been listening. So one of my favorite golden age film composers is Miklos Rocha, whose name I hopefully approximated. He is Hungarian. And my all-time favorite of his scores is El Cid, which is not a great movie as epic historical epics films go, but the music is glorious. Anyway, so I've been doing more of a deeper dive into some of his lesser-known works, and I was really enjoying the score to I think it's basically the Italian translation of Sodom and Gomorrah. So another biblical historical epic from the 60s. And this to me sounds in some ways like a precursor to El Cid. So you can hear some orchestration similarities. You can hear some structural similarities in the music, much as how, and this is getting really nerdy, if you listen to, I think, Humanoids from the Deep by James Horner, it kind of sounds like Star Trek II-ish, like the warm-up for that score. Mm. So in a very similar, it's fascinating to hear how composers evolved their styles and how you'd hear rudiments in an earlier work and then a fully-fleshed, glorious incarnation of the same approach. So Rozsa was a symphonist. I think he was in many ways a precursor to the John Williams soaring strings kind of sound, certainly an influence. And his talent for these giant, lush orchestrations, which were meant to fill these historical, epic landscapes of the cinema of the era, which in turn was competing with TV, are signature and memorable. So if you're new to Miklos Rozsa, I'd say just go straight for El Cid. But if you've listened to that, check out Sodom and Gomorrah.
Mm, cool.
What about you, Alex?
Right, yes. So actually... on the 26th of December, my entire family, so my two kids and my wife, we went to see the opera here in Stockholm. We saw La Boheme, and that's actually about a few months before that, we also saw La Traviata in Germany when I was traveling there. So what have I been consuming? I guess live classical performance. So La Boheme was really good. Actually, in a few weeks, I'll be going with my son to hear another Swedish orchestra play Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony, which I'm really looking forward to. Nice. But it was quite interesting, actually, because of the big grand opera hall in Stockholm where the Stockholm Opera plays. Beautiful, beautiful old building. Ergonomically, not really the greatest. Definitely not built for modern standards. And also acoustically pretty lousy. But as an interesting benefit from that, because the acoustics were just so dead, so utterly dry and dead, the result of that was that the orchestra, you know, they were just really on it. And you could tell that they're used to playing in that space because any of the tiniest mistakes and you're going to hear it immediately because it's just so dead. There's no kind of liveliness in the room to kind of cover up errors. And so, as a result, the Royal Stockholm Opera Orchestra, they were like a tight rock band. Just like so on it, just like crisp and tight and just like hitting all the cues really precisely. And I was like, wow, this orchestra's fantastic. And then I realized, well, they are fantastic because they're used to playing in this very unforgiving space. So, yeah, that was a fun adventure. In the Shostakovich's Fifth is going to be in another larger, more recent modern concert hall. And that's a different orchestra, a larger orchestra. I expect that they're going to be much more grander in scale, being that they're used to operating in a much more lively, much more modern concert hall. So yeah, that's going to be interesting too. That's me. How about you, Vince?
I've been listening to this one dude that, I don't know, I think you might get a kick out of him, Mike, because he is an older Japanese composer, but he writes in sort of a golden age film music style. This dude is named Asakawa Tomoyuki. And he's known for composition and arrangement for a lot of older anime. Of course, nowadays, anime is just bursting out the seams. But back in the day, okay, there were a couple that made it. And you might have heard of some of these things. Jungle Emperor Leo, which was famously considered one of the uncited sources for The Lion King. He was a composer and arranger on that soundtrack. And Five Star Stories. Yes. Which is a very, very famous long-running series that was made into a movie, which a lot of critics had various thoughts on, but the music is absolutely beautiful, just gorgeous, gorgeous writing. He's not really well known as a composer these days. He's more of a working first call studio harpist in Japan.
Wow.
But cool. But his music composition is absolutely beautiful. And I just want to put his name out there because, you know, there's a lot of recency bias in the anime world, what with all the stuff that is out there. This guy was doing stuff in the 80s and 90s and is just gorgeous stuff.
Perhaps you can post a link when you share this episode on social media, just as a supplement.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to find some of his stuff. However, the Five Star Stories movie soundtrack is available on YouTube, so I can probably put a link to that right in the description.
Cool.
Okay, it's been an hour, so I guess it's time to call it an episode. So this was episode 236 of the Game Audio Hour. If you liked what you heard, feel free to support us by subscribing to us at your podcast purveyor of choice and leaving us a review to keep us in the forefront of the algorithm. You can also follow us on Twitter at Game Audio Hour, where we will post notices about future episodes, as well as try to support some other fun and positive voices out there in the Twitterverse. And of course, the easy way to do all of this without having to remember any of what I said the last minute is to go to GameAudioHour.com. So go ahead and do that while we rework our DAW templates for the umpteenth time. Bye.
See y'all.
I don't use any templates. Does that count?
Okay, whatever. Yeah, all right.